Hey, it's the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. We've got a great show for you today. It's all about free speech and how to defend it and enlarge it. So in the late 1970s, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, famously and controversially defended the right of neo-Nazis to march through the Chicago suburb of Skokie, Illinois, which was home to many Holocaust survivors. It was a defining moment, not just for the group, but for the idea that free speech, no matter how vile and disgusting, has to be guaranteed to everyone if anyone is really going to benefit from it. Over the past 20 years, though, and especially over the past few years, the ACLU has kind of retreated from its unwavering defense of free speech in favor of supporting progressive candidates and causes. It ran ads supporting Stacey Abrams in her gubernatorial campaign in Georgia, for instance, and it's called for the forgiveness of $50,000 in student loan debt. It even ghostwrote and placed the Washington Post op-ed about domestic violence that led Amber Heard to lose a defamation case against Johnny Depp. Its lack of focus on its traditional mission of defending free speech has gotten to a point where its former executive director, the guy who led the group during the Skokie March, has become one of its biggest critics. If the Skokie case happened again, Ira Glasser told me on the Reason interview in 2020, would the ACLU take it? I don't know, he said. But if the ACLU is retreating, another free speech group is expanding to fill the void left behind. This is good news. Founded in 1999 to combat speech codes on college campuses, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, has announced a new name and an expanded mission of defending free speech off campus as well as on. The new name for the group is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and it's raised about $29 million for a three-year, $75 million litigation, opinion research, and public education campaign aimed at boosting and solidifying support for free speech values. FIRE's longtime president is Greg Lukianoff. He's the co-author of the best-selling book, The Coddling of the American Mind. And as it happens, he used to work at the ACLU. He loves the group, and he has nothing but praise for the ACLU. In today's episode, he tells me, though, about why he's concerned that support for what he calls the culture of free speech, broad-based support for things, you know, like tolerance and disagreement in the public square, has been declining for the better part of a decade, and how FIRE is going to work to turn that all around. Here is the Reason interview with Greg Lukianoff. Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
Yeah, it's gonna take some getting used to.
Thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick. Good seeing you.
So you've announced a three-year, $75 million campaign aimed at pushing free speech values. Why this action now?
Well, you know, I've been working with FIRE since we were really small, since we were about a year and a half old. I joined in 2001. And pretty much from day one, people have been asking us to take our advocacy off campus and extend nationally. Those requests only got more adamant in the past five or six years. And, you know, my feeling was that we had to have really good coverage on campus first, that essentially if we didn't have ways to poll students to find out what the atmosphere on campus was like for free speech that would allow us to do our ratings, for example, I wanted to make sure that we were doing everything we possibly could on campus first. So we kind of had it in our heads, since people have been approaching us about this forever, to do this in 2024, because that's our 25th anniversary. But 2020 was such a scarily bad year for freedom of speech. On campus and off, we decided to accelerate that process.
What was so bad in 2020?
It was kind of funny because we thought it was going to be a quiet year on campus because most campuses were closed, and we saw more cases in 2020 than we've ever seen ever. You know, like a busy year at FIRE, we get about 1,000 requests for help, which is remarkable because there's only about 600 schools educate about 80% of four-year students, which, you know, a lot of people don't actually know that. But during a year when 80% of campuses were closed, we got 1,500. We got 50% more requests. We had the busiest June of our entire existence. And meanwhile, off campus, you started seeing, you know, stuff that people have really tried to dismiss as not being all that important. But when you have, you know, Andrew Sullivan, Barry Weiss, James Bennett, you know, all in the course of Matty Iglesias, people who like founded their own brands, stepping away from them, saying that the environment was too intolerant. Also, you had the Harper's letter, you know, which was also dismissed, you know, by people, particularly on Twitter. 150 left or left leaning people, they condemned Trump, but then said that, you know, basically, even though they didn't use the term cancel culture was a real problem. So it was really a remarkable year. And we realized that one of the things that has become sort of central to the way FIRE thinks about things, which is not just First Amendment, not just freedom of speech law, but free speech culture, was something that we didn't want to leave it to other people to make that argument.
Yeah, discuss what goes into building a robust culture of free speech. We kind of understand legally what it means, you know, robust First Amendment protections in the courts. But you're talking about something bigger and a bit different than that. What is a free speech culture?
Well, probably the best thing I've written on this to this day was actually at Reason. It was an online debate I did with our friend Ken White. He thinks free speech culture is an incoherent idea. And I think free speech culture is what created the First Amendment in the first place. And it's what makes it useful. A lot of countries have promises of freedom of speech that mean nothing because they have no free speech culture. But, you know, a lot of times I attribute one easy way to explain some of the elements of free speech culture. They're well reflected in our small d democratic idioms that the two of us grew up with. And I think people around our age and probably, you know, a chunk younger as well. Things like everyone's entitled to their opinion, which is something you heard all the time when we were kids. It's a free country, you know, to each their own, you know, statements of deep pluralism, you know, like the idea, walk a mile in a man's shoes. All of these things are they're great principles for taking advantage of pluralism, but they've largely sort of fallen out of usage due to, I think, a growing skepticism about freedom of speech, particularly on campus, that's been about 40 years in the making. And so we do occasionally, like Ken's point is essentially that, you know, one, hypocrites, you know, a lot of times argue free speech culture, but I'm comfortable with that. Essentially, like the idea that hypocrites are going to agree with you is something I just kind of take for granted. You know, it's like you can't let that stop you doing the right thing that some jerks agree with you.
What would you say is the main contributor to the demise of a culture of free speech? You know, the one that you and I grew up with.
Yeah, I would say that the main contributor to the demise of free speech is essentially that on campus, the minority point of view that essentially free speech, meaning, you know, political speech, you know, should be allowed on campus was once an unpopular position. It wasn't that campuses were conservative. They've liberal professors have always outnumbered conservative professors, you know, about 2-1 back then. Now it's about 6-1. But I think that over time, when you go from having a minority opinion to actually being in charge, it's a fairly natural, if disappointing, process to start seeing free speech as part of the problem. There's a book by Michael Barabay and Jennifer Ruth that came out about academic freedom recently that says as much, that essentially, well, of course, we're making different arguments when you're, you know, protesting the university president's office. You know, you should make different arguments when you're actually in charge. And that's essentially what I think has happened. And it's partially because academia has not been willing to admit to itself, at least, that it is incredibly privileged, incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful, and extremely politically homogenous, especially when it comes to administrators. They can't really own the fact that, in a sense, they are now the man, and therefore it's to be expected that they will work harder to control freedom of speech. So I do actually think lack of viewpoint diversity on college campuses has had outsized effects that a lot of people don't appreciate.
Yeah, nobody wants to admit that they have hegemony, right? Especially if you're coming from a left perspective where you're dismantling hegemony and you never really expect to kind of wield it. How do you answer the, you know, one critique, which I think, you know, is worth taking seriously, is that for all this talk about how, you know, speech is being shut down right and left, you know, there's cancel culture, this and that. The fact is right now more people have more ability to espouse more points of view in public than ever before. And that what we're actually seeing is not a retreat from free speech, but it's kind of actual personification. And now suddenly you have a lot of people representing older traditional points of view who are crying, you know, nobody's taking them seriously, or people are merely rebutting them in public. What do you do with that kind of argument?
I mean, there's the argument that, I'll take the first one first, that speech has never been freer because more people are able to talk than ever before. I think that's an argument I don't take all that seriously, because speech was freer in 2005 or 2010. That essentially, when you still had Russia that was pretending that it was, you know, small L liberal, and China that it was liberalizing the Turkey, you know, before you started having the decrease of the democratic recession, as Jamie Dimon called it, that even within our own recent lifetime, I think speech has been more free. If you're just making the argument that more people are online, which essentially seems to be that, a lot more people are online in countries that have no free speech, like China. You know, China has its own separate great firewall. Russia has completely closed the doors on freedom of speech. So I think it's wrong in its premises from the beginning. I think that there was reason to be optimistic about smaller liberalism even in 2005. It's looking like it's on the ropes at the moment. And what was the second part of that?
That, you know, what people are saying is cancel culture is actually merely points of view being challenged for the first time en masse.
That argument. I wrote a long piece in the Daily Beast with Comey Frey about this, just going through the stats and making the point that even if you just look at the number of professors who have been targeted for cancellation since 2015, or for that matter, even just the ones who have actually been fired, let alone the even larger number who have been punished in some way, we're talking about something historic here. Like, we're talking about something that when hundreds of professors being fired within a relatively short period of time is something that you have to go back decades before you see anything even vaguely like that. And we still have people claiming, oh, just these people don't like being criticized. It's like, no, there's a big difference between lots of people getting fired for their opinion and people not like being criticized. It's one of the reasons why I'm actually, this is the first time announcing this. I'm co-authoring a book with someone who writes for Reason, Ricky Schlott. She's a 21-year-old wunderkind who's been amazing to work with, and we're doing something. The book is tentatively titled "The Canceling of the American Mind," because I am tired of having to make the argument that cancel culture is real. I have one thing to add about cancel culture, which is I never really particularly liked the term cancel culture myself. I changed my mind when we started doing the research for this expansion and saw that Black, white, liberal, conservative Americans are fine with the term. They're terrified of the phenomena. They're afraid they're going to lose their jobs if they're actually sincerely say their point of view. And it dawned on me that if we do the thing that Twitter would like you to do, which is keep on changing the term to make, I don't know, Jason Stanley happy or something like that, and you're not going to succeed, by the way, that you're going to be in that process, you're going to be leaving most Americans out of the conversation. So what is colloquial known as cancel culture, even if I part of me still winces a little bit when I say it, it is the accepted term for the weird phenomena that we've been living in for a while now, that just a lot more people are losing their jobs for saying what they saying their political point of view.
You've raised $29 million of the $75 million that you're talking about so far. Who is paying for it?
It's overwhelmingly individuals. This was something that I talked about in when I talked to Josh Gerstein. There was an exclusive at Politico that the reporter Josh Gerstein did. It is overwhelmingly individuals. About 69% of the people of our donations come from individual donors. And there's always a question about foundations and about whether or not we have more. And when it comes to that 69%, that's liberals and conservatives and independents. I know from talking to them, you know, and they're I consider myself a liberal. There are people who actually still strongly identify with freedom of speech. When it comes to the foundations, there is one of the ways that people like to argue on the Twitters, you know, is to say, to fixate on kind of like, but you receive money from conservative and libertarian foundations. And my answer is yes, and you should be very proud of them, because we routinely defend people who hate their guts. And we never get any foundation saying that they're taking back our funding. But when it comes to the liberal foundations, it has been disappointing. Like, I came in, you know, in 2006, when I became permanent president of FIRE, with a little bit of an idea.
President for life of FIRE.
Yeah, president for life. Yes, exactly. I went from interim president to president in 2000. That's what I meant by permanent. Because I wasn't really sure I loved being legal director. I wasn't really sure I wanted to be, I wanted to stay as president. I kind of thought that, you know, I can do this. I can bring in more left-leaning foundations. And that's been a struggle, unfortunately. They associate free speech on campus in particular with the right, even though we defend free speech all the time. And I think that the fact that this is the first nonprofit I ever worked for where you had people who actually voted for different major party candidates. Now, when I worked at the ACLU in 1999, you know, people voted for the Democrats or the Green Party. But the idea of actually having an organization that has Republicans and Democrats working together, it was disappointing to discover that, you know, just the fact that my executive director is a Republican and an evangelical, a fact of which I'm extremely proud, was counted against us.
Speaking of the ACLU, the move that you guys are making is widely interpreted as a response to the ACLU's drift away from defending unpopular but constitutionally protected speech. A couple of years ago, you guys FIRE produced a documentary about longtime ACLU head Ira Glasser, who retired in 2000, that was highly critical of these past two decades of leadership at ACLU, especially Executive Director Anthony Romero. What has gone wrong with the ACLU?
Well, when it comes to the ACLU, we have a principle at FIRE, is we don't fight other nonprofits unless attacked. And, you know, what you mentioned, Anthony Romero, he wrote this morning saying that, you know, he thinks it's great that what FIRE is doing. He wants more people in the space. We've worked with the ACLU since day one at FIRE. We've done lawsuits with them over the years. I still have, you know, a lot of friends over there. And we're happy to work with them, going forward. So I think I might sometimes disappoint people by, not wanting to badmouth the ACLU. But, you know, like Nadine Strawson is someone who FIRE works with very closely. I write, you know, at this point, almost on a weekly basis with her. And she's, you know, she's a proud member of the ACLU.
But she's also a serious critic, as is Ira Glasser, right? I mean,
Nadine?
Yeah,
I don't
of the ACLU and their approach to hate speech or broadening, starting to say that, that hate speech harms should be balanced against free speech absolutism.
She definitely has said that, but I don't think the ACLU has come out in favor of hate speech restrictions, have they?
Well, you tell me. I mean, they after Charlottesville, they had helped the protesters at Charlottesville, the alt-right guys, get the right to permits to actually have it. Afterwards, they said that they were not, you know, they were going to take into consideration the aims of the groups that they're helping get free speech permits for.
I thought that was primarily about whether or not they were armed.
Okay. And even that, I mean, you don't see the ACLU as walking away from its historic commitment to free speech and to the First Amendment, kind of uber alles.
You know, like I said, we've worked with the ACLU. There are still great free speech people there. It's not, you know, I'm not going to badmouth them.
Can I ask, so just follow up, the ACLU did play a surprising and generally underappreciated role in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard defamation suit. The group helped Heard write the Washington Post column that as Depp ended up suing over. Is that, is that a wise use of the ACLU, or will FIRE start to do that kind of advocacy work?
We are definitely going to be writing everybody's op-eds from this point on.
And I hope you'll read them as well, right? So, because that's, they need to be read as well as written.
But. Nick, I made a point, I make this a lot on, particularly in the age of social media. I'm like, I hereby refuse to learn anything about this thing that's currently in the news because there are not enough hours in the day. And that was essentially my position with the Johnny Depp Amber Heard thing.
Yeah.
Is it Heard or Head?
Heard.
heard. Oh, geez, I've been getting her name wrong. And then it turns out there's this like whole free speech angle that I'm just learning about now. And now I want to know, because because the one thing I heard was it was a defamation lawsuit. And when I heard Johnny Depp was suing someone for defamation, I was like, well, good luck with that. I mean, it's like, it's very, very hard under New York Times v. Sullivan to find a celebrity was defamed. And it should be. I'm a big supporter of New York Times v. Sullivan. So I was really shocked to discover that it was that a jury actually found for him. So unfortunately, that might mean I'll have to go back and familiarize myself with that case.
Do you think the fact of that, and he had lost a defamation suit against the Sun in England, which, you know, where it's easier to win defamation suits or libel suits. Do you think, you know, the idea is that at all a bellwether that speech rights are being restricted? Because this seems, you know, unimaginable 20 years ago that a celebrity would win this kind of lawsuit.
And that's the thing. It's always a very fact intensive endeavor. And I don't know if this is going to be turned over on appeal, for example. Mm-hmm. But since how hard it is to win these lawsuits is so high, the fact that you could even be in the ballpark of that is a pretty damning fact to begin with. And when it comes to you know FIRE's overall position on free speech, we mostly think that the Supreme Court has been mostly right on a lot of these things. So we don't believe that defamation isn't a category. We just think that it should be a keeping with New York Times v. Sullivan, where it has to be what's called actual malice, which doesn't actually mean actual malice. It just means that you either were knowingly lying or were so egregiously sloppy that you essentially, you know, you showed what's called reckless disregard for the truth. So I do think that, you know, most of the protected, unprotected categories of speech we think make sense. When it comes to obscenity, that's one of the ones where I disagree somewhat. I think 18-year-olds above a certain age, as long as you're not talking about child pornography, should be able to watch whatever adult material they want.
And could you just run through the argument of why obscenity should not be a legal category?
Should not be a legal category. Well, that essentially the... Yeah, it's kind of like the Miller case. It talks about contemporary community standards, which of course means that it's regionally limited. That part's a little bit outmoded because the internet is everywhere. And you have seen successful cases, by the way, where which I'm sure you know, but your listeners might not, that they bring litigation in, you know, say like most conservative county in some part of the U.S., and they'll bring it against people who make adult movies and then are able to file obscenity charges against them. And this has happened in the recent past. We know some people in common who have been sued under this very ploy, and which is why I think that in reality, what's happened to the obscenity standard is that it's effectively become one that says something pretty close to, if you're above a certain age, you should be allowed to consume whatever media you want. And I think that the law should reflect that.
Do you worry that, you know, going back to this question of a culture of free speech, the emphasis that we're seeing in certain states, you know, particularly Florida, maybe in Texas, with Republican majorities in, you know, in the governor's house as well as in the state legislature, starting to go after things as grooming or as adjacent to child pornography and trying to restrict free speech, you know, based on the idea that it is obscene.
Talk a bit about that. And that's something that another thing that made us all the more convinced that we had to move more. We were originally talking about, we have a big event in New York where we were planning to, at one point we were thinking, oh, we'll just announce this in April 18th of next year. And we just had to move much faster than that. The behavior by a lot of the Republican legislatures, in the state legislatures, has been one of the things that made it even clearer we had to hurry up. One thing that has been a little frustrating watching this, though, when it comes to some of the bad laws that have been passed, is that, you know, people, when they look at Florida, the main thing that you hear about are the things related to K-12 curriculum. Legislatures traditionally have had a role in deciding what curriculums are. And whereas DeSantis passed something applying to higher ed which is unquestionably unconstitutional. So it's been weird watching sort of like the priority of the media taking some things that are, you know, you may think they're idiotic, but they're probably constitutional, and then kind of ignoring stuff that Republican legislatures have been doing that absolutely no question are unconstitutional.
Why are laws that, might pass constitutional muster dictating the curriculum of K through 12 education? Why does that become unconstitutional when it's applied to higher education?
Yeah, well, you've actually tweeted a little bit about this, is that you would think that people would be making the argument that what's going on in K through 12 with the divisive concept / anti-CRT bills is a great argument for vouchers, essentially. So K through 12, it's mandatory. It involves children who parents are considered to rightfully have some power over, taxpayer funded. And if you remove some of those categories, then the argument gets much weaker that there should be democratic involvement in deciding. If people actually had a choice that they could take their voucher and go to whatever school they wanted to, a lot of this concern goes away. But under those circumstances, that involves people's children, that it's mandatory, that it's taxpayer funded, I'm a parent myself. Like the idea that, you know, when I've seen people say that we should leave every decision in K through 12 curriculum to ed school graduates, I'm like, I can't go with you there. But when it comes to higher education, it's night and day in what we think of the function that's supposed to be. It's not a spectrum. It's considered to be, you know, K through 12 and then giant leap. And then it's the institution where the most junior members are 17 or 18 years old, but they go all the way up to, you know, retirement age, right, and beyond. And it's,
I have encountered many academics who are beyond retirement age, yes, but are still on campus.
Absolutely. And it's supposed to be the way we figure out what is true in the world, that these are epistemic institutions writ large, that essentially they're supposed to be able to ask the unaskable, question the unquestionable. It plays a very specific role that any, you know, to quote the Supreme Court, any straitjacket upon their freedom of speech, is harmful to democracy itself. I mean, like the end of that quote is that our civilization will stagnate and die. This is the famous Sweezy 1957 decision that really established the idea that academic freedom is of particular importance to the First Amendment.
Do you think in terms of higher education, because a lot of the speech codes coming out of universities are pushed from the left, virtually all of the laws curtailing what might be taught publicly funded higher education institutions are coming from the right. Is it at all possible that the kind of dialectic of that will yield to a synthesis of saying, why are we talking about any of this stuff? Higher education should really be an absolute free speech zone as much as such a thing can be possible.
Yeah, the culture war, like watching both. And I don't even want to say extremes. I feel like it's become, you know, fairly mainstream to have some pretty anti-free speech points of view on either side. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I like libertarians so much, as they've been some of our best and most consistent allies over the years. They actually mean it, that everybody should get this. The idea that it will result in something, you know, some better middle ground, I'm not totally sure we're in that world anymore. You know, like I feel like that is a hope for possibly a more reasonable time than we're in. That being said, there are signs. So I wrote a feature-length article for Reason for the December, January, it came out in December issue, talking what I called the second great age of political correctness. And my argument in that is essentially there was this first great age of political correctness, which was roughly 85 to 95, where you had people, you know, the founders of critical race theory, Richard Delgado, Mary Matsuda, advocating for speech codes on campus. They were pretty successful. And they really started getting passed in 1985. And then for the next 10 years off campus, you had, and the complaints came from the right and the left saying, this is ridiculous. Like, we just got used to the idea that campuses are supposed to be uniquely a free speech zone. We found that really compelling. And now you're trying to shut the door behind you. And so these, the speech codes lost. There were a lot of crazy, what was then called sort of political correctness type cases. And unfortunately, after the last code was defeated in court at my alma mater, Stanford, just 2 years before I got there, by the way, and amazingly, nobody was talking about that having ever happened or even been a thing. There was a sense that that's all over. You know, now we can take our eye off the ball. And my whole point in that is that the 20 years between the first great age of political correctness and the second great age of political correctness, which begins around 2014, things got much, much worse on campus. So my biggest takeaway is that, yes, things cannot keep up, whether you want to call it cancel culture or just an unusually liberal period in American history. It can't keep up being quite this crazy forever, because eventually you run out of people to cancel, for one thing, and everybody gets in line. But if we leave this and we just say, you know, like, thank goodness that's over, it's just going to come back faster and even worse the next time. So I think that we need to be thinking about much more serious reforms, particularly to higher education. The idea that we are talking about canceling student debt, which I could be very supportive of if it were tied to the idea, and in doing this, we are also, it would be insane for us not to massively decrease how expensive higher education currently is. My preferred way, of course, is by cutting down on how over-bureaucratized it's become.
And the bureaucracy exists in part to serve political correctness or cancel culture.
Yeah. Well, also to deal with how regulated they are as well. And so there are ways that we should be thinking about ways to make universities more rigorous, less expensive, less bureaucratized, to have mm-hmm. more options, all of this kind of stuff. And I'm afraid that if things get returned somewhat to normal or whatever counts as normal now, that there's going to be a sense that, oh, thank goodness that's over. Let's move on to the next thing. And it just means that campuses are going to get still more expensive and still more liberal.
Before we continue with the Reason interview with Greg Lukianoff, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp, an online therapy platform that gives you personalized video, phone, or even chat counseling. It's a great service that I can personally recommend. Could you be suffering from burnout? The last few years have been especially tough on all of us, and it's not surprising that all of us seem more ragged out than usual. COVID, inflation, uncertainty about everything has really been turned up to 11. Life can always be overwhelming, you know, in the best of times, and these, my friend, are not the best of times. Do you find yourself working too much or too little? Is it hard to find joy in your job, your relationships, even the food that you eat? You might be suffering from burnout. BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life and to deal with it. I know BetterHelp did that for me personally. I used the service for more than a year, a couple of years ago, and it really, really helped me deal with stress, anxiety, depression, all in a personalized way that responded to my needs, not the needs of the doctor or the insurance company or anything else. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you could be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Try doing that with a traditional counselor. Our listeners here at The Reason Interview get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/brain. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/brain. And now, back to The Reason Interview with Greg Lukianoff. Was there a golden age of free speech, or if not a golden age, a better time? And, you know, when was that? What did it look like, and what gave rise to it?
So I talk about the golden age fallacy, you know, that, and this comes up a lot, that essentially it's like, oh, my opponent here that came up in my debate with Ken, that you know, these supporters are imagining there was some perfect time in the past, some golden age of freedom of speech, and no, there was no perfect time. And, you know, I call that a fallacy because I don't think most serious people are actually arguing that. However, just the way you phrase it there, do I think there were better times for it? Well, absolutely. I think that it's funny. I think it was Jeffrey Sachs who was really skeptical that some of the polling that had been done in the 1950s said that people's, you know, support for freedom of speech was higher than he would have thought. As from our polling, as best we can tell, there was a high watermark, particularly on campus, for freedom of speech in the mid-70s, which isn't really, you know, a surprise. When I talk to people like Virginia Postrel, who was at Princeton, you know, former editor at Reason.
Right. And a member of your board, correct?
Yes.
Or, yeah, at FIRE.
Yep. And she says, you know, the late 70s in Princeton really was, you know, like a period where people would argue about anything and not really think twice about being as offensive as possible. So I think there have been better moments in how we talk across lines of difference. I think there have been better moments for freedom of speech when it comes to the culture. When it comes to the law is about as good as it's ever been. When it comes to the culture, our argument is that it's gotten a lot worse and that we don't have to accept it that it's this way. There are so many benefits to being able to talk across lines of difference, to recognizing or just letting, you know, being able to be friends with people you disagree with.
How much of that shift was due? I mean, you know, part of it, there were legal landmark or legal cases after World War II, particularly towards the end of the 50s and the early 60s. You were talking about Sullivan. Is one of them, which dealt with, you know, the level of, you know, of defaming a public person. But there were, you know, things like obscenity cases against, you know, Allen Ginsberg's Howl. There was the final legal ability to, without worrying about being dragged into court, to publish books like Lady Chatterley's Lover, The Tropic of Cancer. There was a new, you know, how much did the lawsuits that expanded free expression help? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, did those give rise to a culture of free speech, or were they kind of inspired by a growing culture of free speech?
I think that these are self-reinforcing trends that essentially, because you had the, you know, FDR, even while, you know, locking up Japanese Americans, was talking about, you know, the four freedoms, you know, in contrast to the totalitarian regimes we were fighting in the Nazis and later
Imperial proposing Japan.
Among the Soviets. He would talk about the four freedoms, one of them being, you know, freedom of religion, of course, but also freedom of speech. And there was some really kind of putting your money where your mouth is, because Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the delegates to the to writing the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights that came after World War II. And there were attempts by the Soviets and the Saudis a couple other repressive regimes to say that we needed to have hate speech banned in all these countries, because that would allow that's the way we could prevent fascism from coming back up. And Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, at the time, and this is very well explained in Yakima Shingama's great book, Free Speech, from Socrates and Social Media. She was really eloquently saying, it's like, no, this is an exception you can drive a car through. Like this is going to be abused. That's the reason why it's in there. And so there was some sincere belief in freedom of speech, even in those early days. And so I think that there was an increase in, you know, small liberalism, like of a greater free speech liberalism. I think that that's one of the reasons why you ended up having some of these appointments to the Supreme Court by FDR that were more free speech protective. The lawsuits the lawsuits and the culture kind of went hand in hand. And I feel lucky enough to have grown up in the 80s, you know, where the state of free speech law was very good in the 80s. Not perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. And the norms of, you know, debating across lines of difference about having a reasonably humble belief that you might actually be wrong on something. I think that maybe 20 years ago might have been the high watermark of free speech culture and free speech law, but I feel like these two have been separated over time.
Whereas the law has held pretty steady, but the free speech culture has disappeared or is declining.
Yeah, and I think that really what you start seeing the decline in free speech culture beginning on campus in the 1980s.
Yeah. So, you know, where does that come from? Because, you know, it seems odd, especially, you know, in maybe not as much in the 80s, but certainly in the 90s, with the rise of cable TV, where suddenly you have many, many more
avenues of expression that are less and less specifically regulated by the government or by the culture, and then the internet especially, where people suddenly you're free to say whatever you want, and you can have an audience too. You don't need to, you know, have a deal with Comedy Central or Netflix or anything, right? You can just put stuff out there. What were the points, you know, or what, you know, what were the pressures that gave rise to not the technology of free speech or the legal limits of free speech, but what started eroding that culture of free speech?
I would say that the refocusing people on hate speech in the 1980s, was one of the great PR, victories for pro-censorship regimes all over the world. And this is something that should be understood, is that, dictatorships will follow America's lead by passing laws that nominally ban hate speech, but are of course used to just crack down on speech that the government doesn't like. They did the same thing, by the way, with fake news, that there were, you know, during the Trump administration, when he popularized that idea, there were countries, that's the code that we get to use now. So I do think on campus, you know, you had the hate speech, the popularization of the idea that this should be an exception to free speech. This became even more popular in Europe, for example. So that was definitely, part of the downward road. When it comes to the current, like the last 10 years, why I think it got so much worse is partially because, and this is the way I put it, social media has the explosion of social media, just over the past 10 or 12 years, is very much like the printing press in a lot of different ways. Like I agree with Martin Gurry that this is like the fifth wave of communications technology. But it's important to remember that the printing press, it let thousands of people communicate to millions. The social media explosion is suddenly billions of people able to communicate directly with each other. There's never been anything even vaguely like this. And sometimes people look at me and John Haidt, and we talk about some of the downsides of social media use, particularly among young people. And they'll say, oh, these technophobes, they would have said the same thing about the printing press. And my response is, you mean the technology that led to 200 years of religious wars in Europe and the crazy popularization of the witch trials? And I feel like where we are right now is like 1521, like when Henry VIII first started to try to regulate the printing press. And essentially, if you look at from the point of view of someone from 1521, they're saying, well, this was a mistake. This has been nothing but a huge headache. It has a couple benefits here and there. But overall, the printing press was a bad idea. I feel like this is where we are with social media, that essentially this is going to be an anarchical period. It's going to be kind of crazy because they've never had a situation where billions of people have been able to communicate to each other before. So what I'm saying here is that I think some of the free speech skepticism does come from this really anarchical period we have, and we want out of it sometimes, and understandably so, because it has been pretty crazy. But my overall view and the overall sort of belief that FIRE has is that in the long run, it's going to be positive. But anything this disruptive, it's not going to be quiet, and there are going to be downsides inevitably. But we can't just, there's no way to just fix it.
Is, with that in mind, then, is FIRE, how do you think, especially as you expand off campus, what will you have to say about platforms like Twitter or Facebook or YouTube and the way that they choose to moderate their content? Because this is one of the big battlegrounds now where people are saying, okay, well, we have censors, that are private companies that, and the libertarian me certainly believes that they have the right to set their terms of service however they want and kind of enforce them even somewhat erratically under both Section 230, but just under, kind of standard practice. How will FIRE weigh in on, whether or not Twitter should ban access to stories like, the Hunter Biden story a couple of weeks before the election, just kind of summarily dismissing certain people or allowing certain people back on? What are the guidelines for that? These private acts of, if not censorship, then speech regulation.
Well, you know, it's like when Elon Musk was still talking about buying Twitter, and you know, I wrote him an open letter. I talked about how you can learn a lot from American First Amendment jurisprudence, not because you have to, not because you're bound by it, but because it's some of the best thought out meditations on how you have free speech in the real world by some of America's best and brightest over a long period of time. Now, what I didn't say in that, you know, is I think it's smart to think about things like, you know, we are one thing that we will promise users is there's no viewpoint discrimination. Like, we're not going to just ban someone because they have a bad opinion, for example. That's a smart thing to borrow from. We don't want government playing Big Brother and coming in and making places do this. But the more social media is viewed as being arbitrary, the more likely that that outside intervention comes. So what we're hoping is that we, by promoting free speech culture and by imploring social medias to voluntarily say that they're going to commit themselves to some of these principles, they can avoid that necessarily totally messed up and eventually probably very corrupt, you know, top-down, not even eventually, probably immediately, top-down influence. So that's one of the reasons why we're advocating for free speech culture, because we believe that social media, if it borrows some of these ideas from philosophical ideas from free speech jurisprudence, they can make themselves better places to actually have democratic deliberation or for just to be a regular human.
And that means a few years ago, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg talked about how he would allow Holocaust denialism on Facebook. He's kind of reversed position on that. But so FIRE would say, you know, as long as you're not inciting imminent harm, you're not doing fighting words or something like that, you know, if people want to espouse Holocaust denialism, let them, and, you know, have people duke it out or give people the tools to avoid that if they want. That it's better to have more speech rather than less speech.
Yeah. Well, I think people think about freedom of speech, you know, wrong. I even have like a pretentious name for my theory, which I call the lab in the looking glass theory, because I think marketplace of ideas is a great idea for higher education, where it is supposed to be this idea that you're arguing it out to try to figure out which ideas are best. But most of the time, freedom of speech isn't about, you know, seeking the objective form of the truth. Most speech is mostly about expressing preferences. You know, there is no ultimate, you know, answer to which band is better than another band, although you might disagree.
Now, you would say that because you have terrible taste, but please continue.
I do have terrible taste. But the and my whole lab on looking glass idea is very simply like a restatement of old humanist principles that everything about people is worth knowing. Everything about humanity is worth knowing. And that even though the fact of your uncle believing that lizard people who live under the Denver airport is not objectively true, knowing that your uncle believes that is actually very useful for you to know, particularly if change the scenario. Going on a date with someone who believes that is probably something you want to know. So I think that making sure knowing what people really believe and why is always important. It's also interesting, one thing that people miss, and this was well covered in a book by John L. Jackson called Racial Paranoia, is that when people think the only reason why, for example, people aren't saying racist things is because they're afraid that they will be brought up under charges of the speech code, they start thinking that people are much more engaging in much more racist speech behind their back than they actually are. So, like, knowing what people really think and what they're willing to say has a value, even if what they're saying is demonstrably wrong.
Right. What about, you know, a lot of the discussion about speech codes, about wokeism, political correctness, whatever we're going to call it, cancel culture, revolves around things like diversity, equity, and inclusion workshops in private corporations, as well as public ones, you know, or public sector jobs and things like that. ESG governance laws that are going into discussions of that are going into corporate investment law and stuff like that. Will FIRE be looking at that and arguing that, you know what, knock it off a little bit with the Robin DiAngelo, Ibram Kendi style anti-racism when you're training your workforce, and instead look for places where people feel more comfort in saying what they actually think about things?
Well, two things there. on DEI, and I really feel like I have to mention this, we just did a big report on the use of DEI statements for the hiring of professors.
And which is becoming huge now, where increasingly both in tenure files, but also in applications for jobs, faculty or prospective faculty are asked to explain how their research program and their pedagogy advances various aspects of a diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda.
Yeah. And our point there is that that's another political litmus test, depending on how it's constructed. And of course, when you look at the lack of viewpoint diversity in higher education, the idea that someone, you know, particularly in the UC system, decided there's way too many heterodox thinkers in academia today, we need to, you know, cull the herd, it just seems absolutely crazy to me. When it comes to the situation of companies thinking of themselves as both expressive associations and as widget factories, they are absolutely within their right to be that. However, if you have a situation in which every company in the country decides that, well, we're a progressive company, or we're a right wing company, and that you will be fired unless you if you say something contrary to that, that's bad for democracy. And so one of the things that I wrote in the afterword for Coddling the American Mind that we've been publishing in Bits on Persuasion, a great website if you haven't checked it out, is how to keep your company out of the culture war. And one of the things we talk about is, you know, Brian Armstrong's saying that
the CEO of Coinbase, exchange,
that he's going to have a politically neutral institution, and that 60 people quit over it, and he gave them severances and everything. That is actually something that more companies should actually be following the lead there, to say, listen, we know we have the right to decide that we have the following narrow viewpoints, and people will be punished if they don't say so. But ultimately, that's not necessarily the best thing for a genuinely pluralistic society. If a brilliant liberal or a brilliant conservative can't find a job in your field because they've all decided that you can't, that this company will, is going to crack down on you actually using your freedom of speech to express your point of view.
Mentioning John Heitch, your co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, which is a major text, really transformed a lot of debates in America. Jonathan Haidt, he is starting to call for more guardrails being put on social media, such as getting rid of anonymous accounts, restricting access to certain ages, things like that. Is that consistent with building a richer, more robust free speech culture?
John and I, he's at much more top down than I am. I'm much more bottom up. When it comes to the not having anonymous people on, I will say that his idea is better than it gets represented. He's not saying that you cannot have a pseudonym, but you have to at some point have been verified by somebody before you have that pseudonym that you exist. And I saw, attaching your Facebook account to comments, for example, did to the quality of comments on websites that use that, and it improved them. Basically, when your actual reputation is attached to what you say, people do generally behave better. I, however, think that most of these changes should be coming bottom up, and I think that they will. That essentially, we have this absolutely huge revolution in social media technology. There's no way that top down this can just be fixed. This can be deus ex machina for you. That essentially we have to create norms around this. And this is one of the things that I've really been advocating for. And I think it's already happening to some degree, that, the idea of people saying, turn off your social, turn off your internet.
Right. Yeah. Delete your account.
As a family. Delete your account for that matter. Ways of, and that's going to be actually what I think is going to get us out of this mess much more than heavy-handed top-down solutions.
So to go back to your earlier analogy about the first decades, or really the first couple of centuries of the printing press, we're in that phase. I always think of this as my parents described getting their first TV in the, I guess, early or mid-1950s. They and everybody else watched it nonstop for like a week and a half. They called them sick, et cetera. And then over time, you realize, okay, I gotta start measuring this out a little bit and moderating myself. your idea is that we're in the beginning of this social media revolution, which really is about users kind of contact or communicating amongst themselves with fewer and fewer kind of mediating institutions. We're moving towards the kinds of norms that will actually make all of this less incendiary.
That's exactly it. And I think that, I'm hoping that as we get more sophisticated about it, it's one of the reasons why like writing a book with Ricky Schlott is something I'm excited about, because she's Gen Z. She's 21 years old. She is someone who sees how younger people who are very socially intelligent can use social media as a way of, you know, playing status games, essentially. Now, the fact that people would do that is obvious from a social science standpoint, and figuring out a better immune system culturally letting that not matter quite as much. So when we were first trying to ask, like, what can you do about, what can companies do when someone comes to cancel, you know, someone, one of their employees, my suggestion from the very beginning was like, slow everything down. And what I mean by that is, these mobs, you know, that pop up on social media that want you to fire this person for tweeting this thing, they don't last very long. They're really intense, but they don't last all that long. And the simple innovation of being like, listen, we have a cooling off period. Like, we will not even start an investigation of this person to see if they did anything wrong for 3 weeks. That's a simple innovation that I think could actually would have helped a lot of people who end up getting canceled in the past 10 years keep their jobs.
I want to ask you one more question about the ACLU. Is FIRE simply doing what the ACLU is often accused of doing, changing its historical mission in response to donor pressure and gaps in the activism market?
Donor pressure, this was definitely the other way around. We decided we wanted to do this, and then we went to try to find if we could get it funded. That essentially we felt, I'm not a religious person, but I do, you know, to use some religious imagery, I felt like a lot of us felt called to this, that essentially, you know, free speech is why you work at FIRE. It's a genuine belief in it. And we saw things getting worse off campus, and we just kind of felt like, you know what, if not us, then who?
At this point, do you feel that the threats are much more significant coming from non-state actors than from governments?
Which non-state actor are you thinking of?
I'm saying, you know, private companies, you know, Facebook, YouTube, Google, Twitter.
Oh, no, I'm always more afraid of governments.
Yeah. So, and
you should always be more afraid of governments.
Even at private universities that are, you know, kind of locking down free speech, the state is still the first biggest threat to free speech.
Well, the state has the guns, you know, as libertarians like to say. I definitely think that I when it comes to higher ed, I don't even know where to begin some days about like what they need to do. Oh, and actually, if I didn't say this already, but if I did, it's worth repeating. FIRE is not going to stop doing anything we're doing on campus. In fact, we're going to do more on campus over the coming years. We're just going to be doing more outside as well. I know it's a very heavy lift. I do think that campuses, I think if we started actually trying to figure out how much critical thinking actually improves in higher ed these days, it would be very quickly clear that we're spending an awful lot of money on something that has a relatively modest effect on critical thinking. The one study that was done 10 years ago showed literally no improvement for about 50% of students, which is amazing, because this was the term of the study was people from the age of 18 to 20. And if I still worked at Burlington Coat Factory from 18 to 20, I can guarantee you my critical thinking skills would have improved during that time. So the idea of having 50% show none during that time was quite damning.
Well, as a final question, at the end of this 3-year campaign, where, you know, FIRE goes from being the foundation for individual rights and education to the foundation for individual rights and expression, at the end of this 3-year campaign, how will you know that you've succeeded or that you're moving in the right direction?
I think seeing a couple companies go, I am not firing this employee. You know, I disagree with them, but I, you know, that's just not something we do. Having that happen sometimes, you know, like as opposed to almost never, would be very reassuring. I think that, you know, you can actually, we've been trying to think about ways you can evaluate it. And that's one of the reasons why it's nice to have a research department now that's top notch. You can actually look into it in terms of, you know, frequency of certain sayings, you know, like those old idioms that I was talking about before could be a way to way to do it. And you can also look at the polling, you know, there was a some, you know, really scary stats. I think there was in a Cato poll talking about how many lefties and right wingers would be okay with someone getting fired if it came out that they had donated to Biden or Trump, to, you know, depending on the scenario. And it was distressingly high. That number going down, I think, would be a very good sign for, you know, actual pluralism.
Hey, let me ask you, and I said that was the final question, just one quick one, because, and sure. I realize, you know, you consider yourself a liberal, not a libertarian, but there, you know, there's a lot of overlap. On that last kind of example that you pointed out, you know, libertarians could argue this two ways. And of course, they could probably argue it 200 ways. But one is that a company, you know, that you are how you act in the market. And so, like, if you vote for Biden and your company's owned by somebody who hates Biden or Trump or whatever, you know, that's actually, it's good for the owner of that company or that community to be like, well, get out of here then. You don't belong here. You know, there's that. And then there's the other version where it's like, you know, we have a business here and this is not the extent of our lives. And we don't want politics to govern every interaction and dictate. How do you, you know, which seems to me, ideally, one of the goals of libertarianism is that you are, everything that you're doing in your life is not directly related to politics and subject to a political analysis. How do you think you shift, you know, you shift the balance from one thing to the other?
Well, I think one of the reasons why, you know, I'm optimistic long term, if not necessarily short term, for the success of freedom of speech, is that a lot of these free speech really works very well, you know, and I think that, and also it's one thing to convince some people of something new. It's another thing to say, remember that thing we all believed 7 years ago that we all thought was actually a higher calling, a moral good? You can still think that. And as best we can tell, our polling from our polling is that it's really a pretty small minority and largely at the top. It's particularly pronounced on Twitter that is sort of anti-free speech philosophically and thinks that people should shut up and conform. I think that once you start giving people permission to believe in these sort of small D democratic norms again, a lot of people are going to reveal their actual preferences. Yeah, you know, I don't want you to fire Larry for who we voted for or for, you know, a dumb joke he made on Twitter. So I think that, you know, I think that part of our job at this point is not so much educating as reminding younger people. Yes, we have to get to them and educate them about some of these principles because they haven't heard them before. But for most Americans, I think reminding them, giving them permission to believe what most Americans believed 7 years ago there's reason to be optimistic about it if the polling is accurate.
Greg Lukianoff for FIRE, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Is there anything else that you want to add or?
Well, I would say that we're looking for, you know, FIRE is looking for three things, you know, more than anything else, you know, obviously support, but also plaintiffs for cases we haven't heard of yet. In our research, we've already found that there are a lot of cases that aren't being litigated yet, which is good for us, but not necessarily good for the country, but we still want to know more. And the last one is talent, you know, that essentially it's really important that an organization like FIRE find top-notch people who really believe in freedom of speech. We're going to be, you know, increasing our staff by a good 40 people in the relatively near future. So, you know, please talk to people in your network. FIRE is hiring and finding those special people who care about this like we do is very important to our success.
Great. Thank you so much, Greg. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please, right now, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts and sign up. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe there. Thanks for listening.